Hello again, and welcome back to Musings on Sports. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with Bob Bopka. Bob, I really enjoyed seeing the kids all dressed up last night for Halloween, out trick-or-treating. I do hope you had more treats at the Bopka household than tricks.
Well, we made an outstanding comeback. We've lived here quite a while, and the number of youngsters that would come to our door dwindled over the last 5 or 6 years. But they made a strong comeback last night, and boy, was it some sight to see. Doorbell rings, Janice pounces and goes to the door, gives him a candy, comes back, eats a candy, sits down, doorbell rings, Janice once again pounces to the door, gives him a candy, comes back, eats a candy. I said, good golly, I hope there are not too many more. She's going to explode.
It sounds like a fun time was had by all. You didn't have any of those Hershey Kisses last night, though, huh, Bob?
Yeah, I'm not a candy man, but it was great to see. And
yeah,
it's just almost a little bit of a sign of the times. I mean, it was gloomy the last 4 or 5 years, maybe total. In the last 5 years, we had 10 trick-or-treaters. Last night, probably close to 25. So I really enjoyed it, and it's such a great holiday for youngsters. I have a few grandkids, and every one of them enjoyed it to the max. I don't know how many times they got to go trick-or-treating, but they certainly had a blast.
Well, I think it's the most enjoyable and fun night of the year, so I'm glad you all enjoyed it as well. Hey, I think our guests are going to really enjoy hearing from Jim Lampley later in the show, Bob. Lampley, 30 years as host of HBO's World Championship Boxing, but just his entree into the world of sports broadcasting through a nationwide search, fascinating hearing from Jim.
Yeah, I never even realized that anything like that would be conducted. They just advertised that they wanted a young, good-looking announcer with a good voice.
Yeah.
And I said, wow. I remember that when that came out, I said, let's see, good voice? Yeah, I can try. Oh, wait a minute, good-looking? Nah, I'll pass.
Face for radio, is that what you're saying, Bob?
Worse.
Hey, now Jim's going to be great. World Series. When we were recording this, game three in Philadelphia on Monday night, Halloween was rained out. Just in general, you know, the city of Philadelphia has been waiting a long, long time for this. It's a rabid fan base. It's a fan base, Bob, whether it's the Eagles, Phillies, Flyers, or Sixers, that live by their sports teams. They travel with them. They're incredibly passionate. And it's going to be a home field advantage, unlike I think any other park really in baseball. They've been waiting. There's been no World Series games played at Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia since 2009. I still expect that the Astros are the better team on paper. And Jose Altuve breaking out with three games in three hits in game two, I think sparked them. But it's going to be a big mountain for the Astros to climb with a huge home field advantage for the Phillies.
Yeah, and you use the words that I think every manager dreads. On paper, we're better.
Yeah.
But it doesn't count on paper. It's got to count on the field. And now the schedule's set. They'll be playing, I guess, on Tuesday night and Wednesday night and Thursday night. And then
Right. They'll
take Friday off to travel and finish it up on Saturday and Sunday. What a sporting day that would be on Sunday if we could have the seventh game of the World Series. Incredible.
Yeah, it would be. Obviously, Phillies fans are hoping that it stays and ends in Philadelphia with games 3, 4, and 5 in Philly and be able to wrap up their first World Series title since 2008 when they won in 5 games over the Tampa Bay Rays. Baseball is reaching its climax, Bob. We're at the halfway point of the National Football League season. Some interesting statistics that really go to show, we use the word parity a lot. I would say that the NFL is more bunched up than anything else in terms of so many teams. Yes, the Eagles and the Bills, and I would throw the Chiefs in there, are the cream of the crop so far. But how about this for statistics? Through 8 weeks of the NFL season, there's been a record number of games decided by 6 points or less. That's a total of 55 games. and a record number of games decided by 8 points or less. That's a total of 71 games through the first 8 weeks of the season. A lot of teams, a lot of close games. The NFL loves that, Bob.
You think Roger Goodell has that smile on his face for no reason? Hey, nothing like an NFL game. Only thing better is a close NFL game, and we certainly have had that. We may have a close one in college football coming up. How about Saturday, Tennessee, number 2, against number 1, Georgia?
Well, I think the games that I've seen so far, I think Tennessee is the best team. I think they've played the best in college football so far this year. Georgia is ranked number 1. Tennessee is either 2 or 3, depending on the poll you look at. Hendon Hooker, the quarterback for Tennessee, has been, in my opinion, I think in just about anybody else's, I think he's been the best player in college football. You don't beat Alabama at home and play the way he did down the stretch and not be recognized, at least right now, as the best. But Stetson Bennett III and an improving Georgia defense, look, they won the national title last year, Bob. They're still a formidable opponent. The edge goes to Georgia because it's at home and because they've won a national championship before. But I would not at all be surprised if Tennessee went in between the hedges in Athens and knocked them off. Should be a tremendous football game.
Yeah, it's one you're going to want to watch. I know I'll be glued to that TV set. All right, how about Liv and its golf season? Your thoughts?
In the books for season 1, changed the very changed everything, brought chaos to professional golf unlike anything before. Brought a lot of riches to a few individuals. Dustin Johnson, 35 million or some silly number. Bob, they've got two big issues, obviously. You know, and they brought in, look, they brought in Koepka, they brought in DeChambeau, they brought in Cameron Smith. They've lured lots of guys with name recognition to LIV Golf. Now, they expand to 14 events next year. The two biggest questions remain the television deal, because frankly, not very many people are watching LIV Golf. It's only basically available in the United States via streaming. And then number 2, the official World Golf ranking points. How that shakes out. Will they get those points so that players who haven't won major championships will continue to be able to be viable in the world ranking system to be able to qualify for the Masters, the U.S. Open, the PGA Championship, and the Open Championship? It's clearly here to stay, okay? It's clearly for a younger audience. There's no doubt about it. The demographics show that. I still struggle with it long term. I just still don't know what's the investment in? What's the long-term play for the Saudis, especially if they can't get a TV deal? It's 54 holes. It still reeks to me a bit of, a little bit of an exhibition in a sense. There's nowhere near the pressure that you have from your golf that's been played at that level down through the years. But I guess, Bob, there's an audience for it. And if they can get it on TV, I think things change.
Yeah, there's two things. If they can get it on TV and if they can get LIV players into the majors. I mean, the Open Championship has already committed that they will be allowed. The real hurdle, I guess, is going to be Fred Ridley and the people at the Masters, what their decision is going to make. Also, they're going to be expanding. They hope to get it up to 60 players. I know a couple of players that they have their eye on, Patrick Cantlay and Xander Schauffele. We'll have to wait and see whether they sign. You know, with 60 players, there's a little more flexibility, even though only 48 will actually play on any given week. So they're doing all the right things, apparently for the wrong reason. So, you know, it's got the golf public somewhat of in a turmoil. You know, you got people that say LIV is good. Others say LIV is bad. Most say, you know, we're tired of LIV. You know, I don't know. I just hope everything gets settled one way or another and golf can go back to being a gentleman's game.
Yeah, I hear you. And I recognize those diverse audiences, if you will, in terms of how they feel. There's still illegal proceedings out there, Bob. I think things still have a long way to play out before there may even ever be peace between the two. Look, if Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay were to leave the PGA Tour and go to LIV, those would be big blows to the PGA Tour. It'd be big blows to the Ryder Cup in particular, because those two guys as partners have had great Ryder Cup success. So there's trickle-down effects there. And in the next few months, you're right, the decision by the Augusta National Golf Club and Fred Ridley as the chairman of the club really will say a lot, will dictate a lot about what the other organizations do as regards to LIV golfers playing in their events.
And I just can't see the Masters restricting LIV players, because that makes their field so much weaker. But hey, what do I know?
No, I think you're right. And I've felt, you know, I've kind of gone back and forth on it. I agree. They stand, the four majors continue to stand way above, and even more so now than the other tournaments that are out there. Why would you ever water down your own field and make your event any less than it is? But we'll see how that all shakes out. And there'll be a lot more that we'll hear about in the coming months, no question about it. You and I heard a lot from Jim Lampley. I thought he was a terrific guest. He is now teaching a course at his alma mater at the University of North Carolina in communications, and he certainly knows how to communicate, Bob.
He's one of the best, and that's why he's been doing boxing for 30 years. I really enjoyed the interview. I really enjoyed his interview, and I think the listeners of Musings are going to be quite fascinated by the story of Jim Lampley.
Yeah, I agree. And we will be hearing from Mr. Lampley right after we hear from our good friends at Titleist.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number. And more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Bob, from being discovered through a national talent search while a student at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, to teaching a class on storytelling at his alma mater today, Jim Lampley has had an extraordinary career in communications. ABC's Wide World of Sports, the Super Bowl, a record number of Olympic Games covered, and 30 years calling the fights on HBO's World Championship Boxing. Jim Lampley has plenty of stories to tell. It's a pleasure to welcome him to Musings on Sports. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing very well. I hope you guys are too.
Hey, Bob Upke here, Jim. Thanks for joining us. And boy, I have to admit at the outset, I am jealous. I covered professional golf now since 1981, and I got more stories than, I don't know. But and if I could find a better way of telling those stories, I would love it. So don't be surprised in the next class you start to teach, you see somebody that looks rather out of place sitting in the front row with his notepad and pencil. Ready to go. One thing I want to ask you, Jim, because I had never heard of it before. Tell us about that national talent search that ABC put on and how that launched your career.
Well, I have to edit this story a little bit in order for it to become short enough that it doesn't eat up our entire time together. But the bottom line was, in 1972, while covering at the Olympics the horrifying kidnap and ultimately murder of Israeli athletes by a Palestinian terrorist group, ABC Sports discovered that certain technologies, wireless cameras, wireless microphones, things of that nature, would perform better and in more situations than they had originally thought would be the case. They learned, for instance, that those transmissions would go around concrete barriers and even metal barriers, and that they could get quality video and audio signals on remote cameras and microphones that they didn't know they could do. And when everyone came back from Munich to New York in fall of 72, they convened a summit up kind of a meeting among the engineering, sports, and news departments and began to discuss, okay, now that we know these things that we learned covering the capture of the Israeli athletes in Munich, what can we do with it? And one of the ideas that came up was, well, we could put a reporter on the sidelines of a football telecast. And eventually that led to, all right, college football, not the NFL, because the NFL might not be terribly receptive to the idea of an announcer on the sidelines. Hasn't ever been done before, but we can use it on college football to help differentiate college football from pro football by showing the feature type stories, the people related stories that are endemic to college football, cheerleaders, mascots, long-standing traditions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And from there, the idea became, okay, let's choose somebody who is, in fact, a college student. And they publicized early in 1974 that they were going to look around the country to find somebody who was not a broadcaster, had no particular on-camera experience, but was representative of the face and voice of the American college student. And they reached out to major universities, the kinds of universities they dealt with on the NCAA football telecast, to get recommendations for the job. Who could that possibly be? They wound up sending out a delegation headed by Rune Arledge's administrative assistant, a guy named Dick Ebersole, to interview, as it turned out, 430 plus student type candidates from campuses all around the United States. The interviews took place at 16 different college sites. They spent more than a month traveling around and sitting with people and talking to them for what was originally planned to be 5 to 7 minutes apiece to begin the screening process to choose the face and voice of the American college student. Now, I didn't fit any of the parameters. I was already a graduate student at the University of North Carolina. I was not an undergraduate. I was not 18 to 22 years old. I turned 25 in April of that year. I was not a raw, unpolished prospect. I had done a good deal of on-camera and on-microphone work here in Chapel Hill during my senior year as an undergraduate and during the period of time that I had gotten started in graduate school. I had done the Dean Smith post-game radio show on the basketball broadcast, radio broadcast. I had done the Bill Dooley show. I think I did 2 seasons of it. So I didn't fit any of the expressed parameters of the profile. And I also made an ass of myself in the first interview when the first person who spoke to me, a producer named Terry Jastro, said with a bright, shiny smile, "What do you think of our idea here?" And I had been number 34 out of 36, drawing out of a hat a number for the interview that day in Birmingham, Alabama. It was 98 degrees outside on the street. I had driven all night from Chapel Hill to get there. I was in a very angry mood. I didn't like the way the whole thing was being presented. And when Terry asked me the question, "What do you think of our idea?" I said, "I think it's the biggest crock of crap that I've ever heard of in my life. I think what you're doing is obviously a sham and stupid. The notion that you're going to go around the country and interview 400 plus college students for 5 to 7 minutes, and from that process begin to choose the face and voice of the American college student is obviously fraudulent. I need to get into my car and go back to Chapel Hill." And on the evaluation form that they would eventually use to remember the people to whom they had spoken, Ebersole wrote, "Arrogant, abrasive, alienated, antagonistic." Later in the college football truck, that would become known as the 4 A's. And whenever I would do something contentious or pitch a fit or complain about something that they were doing on the telecast, someone would bring up the four A's. Here we go again. Alienated, arrogant, abrasive, antagonistic. So I was out. I was flushed out of the process. I drove back to Chapel Hill and, you know, told my wife and various other people, forget that. I wasn't in a good mood. It was a long drive. Obviously, I'm not going to be that person. And they continued forward, narrowing down, getting ready to choose, et cetera, et cetera. And then in August, on August 8th, the day that Richard Nixon announced he was resigning the presidency, I got a call at a rented beach house on the coast of North Carolina. And I still do not know to this day how Dick Ebersole got that number. It was a hardline phone on the wall of a rented beach house. The phone rang. A friend of mine who was with me on that little vacation trip picked it up, said, yeah, he's right here. Who can I say is calling? Jim, it's Dick Ebersole. And I'm like, what in the world is this all about? And I got onto the phone, and Dick began kind of hemming and hawing and basically said, we have run into a little bit of a jam up here trying to go forward with our choice. And now Rune, one word only, nobody had to say Rune Arledge. Everybody in sports television knew who he was. He was the dominant executive in the business. Rune has decided that maybe we should talk to someone with a little bit of on-camera experience, so we're certain that this is going to work well. And some of the people who had met you said, we should talk to you again. And I said to him, I said, Dick, you and I had a contentious experience talking about this in Birmingham. I put this out of my mind a long time ago. You said you were going to choose somebody who never had any experience in broadcasting. I have a great deal of it already. And he said, yeah, yeah, I understand, but sometimes ideas change, et cetera. Long story short, they sent me to Birmingham, Alabama to do an audition interview with a former University of Miami quarterback named George Myra, who had flunked out of the NFL, the AFL, the Canadian Football League, and was now playing in one of those bogus spring football leagues with a team called the Birmingham Americans. And they thought, okay, this will be a challenge because maybe he doesn't even know who George Myra is. And it's a reclamation story for the interview, and it'll be interesting. Well, they had not done enough research to know that I went to junior high school and high school in Miami. I had season tickets for University of Miami football games when I was down there. I was probably the only person in the United States outside of the Myra family who still had a number 10 University of Miami jersey hanging in my closet because George Myra was the object of hero worship for me. And I chuckled to myself when I thought, this is really too good to be true. And I said, yeah, Dick, I can get on a plane. I can go to Birmingham, et cetera, et cetera. And when I hung up the phone, I turned around to my wife and my friends and said, I'm going to be this college age reporter on ABC Sports College Football. Huh? How do you know that? I said, because it's obviously something that the universe wants me to do. Number one, I'm back in the game after months of accepting that there was no chance. And number two, they're sending me to interview somebody about whom I probably know more than anybody else they could find in the whole country. And I went to Birmingham and I did the interview with George Myra, and I sent the footage to New York, and they called me a few days later and said, we need you to do this job. And the first game is September 7 in Knoxville, Tennessee, between Tennessee and UCLA. They actually chose two of us because they had been fixated for quite a while on a guy from Stanford named Don Tolleson. So that first season, there were two of us on the sidelines. And of course, what they had articulated to the media and to the world was that the person they chose was going to do one season, and then there would be a different one every year thereafter. I wound up doing three seasons. Don was sent to Philadelphia to work at a local ABC affiliate. And the three seasons led because of the influence of the producer in the truck, a guy named Chuck Howard. Those three seasons led to getting started doing the funky wide worlds, you know, the wrist wrestling, the Orient World of Self-Defense, the Lumberjacks competition, the New York State's Firemen's competition. Every other announcer on the staff had done all those things at least once, maybe twice. I now became the only person to do them three, four, five times. I think I went to Hayward, Wisconsin for the Lumberjacks four times. And I got a, you know, a long apprenticeship and training experience that ultimately made me a real announcer on the commentary staff for ABC Sports. And they did choose a successor at some point. And the bottom line is that if you were alive in 1974 and you saw me on the sidelines of the college football game, you might have said, wow, what is this? I've never seen anybody do this before. Now there is no football telecast that does not have somebody with a camera and a microphone on the sidelines.
Well, you're right about that. And it sounds like it might have been easier for you to get a starring role in a Hollywood movie than get that job. You know, you've worked with Jim McKay, Howard Cosell, Al Michaels, all legends. How was that working with legendary broadcasters as such?
I knew that any contact I had with Cosell would be a nightmare.
Did it turn out to be that way?
Oh, yeah. I attempted for a long time not to have any contact with Cosell, but you could. I moved to New York. I got myself an office in the building. And by the way, I did everything that Keith Jackson told me not to do. We were midway through that first college football season. Keith Jackson reached out after a production meeting and said, would you like to come to my room tonight and share a bottle of Stoli? And I thought, wow, Keith Jackson wants to talk to me. What is this all about? And I went to his room, and somewhere in the second glass of Stoli on the rocks, he stood in front of me and said, let me give you a little advice. Never move to New York. Never go to 1330 Sixth Avenue. Never go to the 28th floor. Do not buy Gucci shoes and Paul Stewart suits like all of those supercilious executives who are chasing the secretaries in the organization. Don't do any of those things. Get yourself a house on the Sunset side of the mountains as far away as you can possibly be from New York. And when the game is over and Chuck Howard and all of his associates get on a plane and fly back to New York, you get on a plane and fly west. If you do that, you'll have a long, successful, and happy broadcasting career. So, of course, I moved to New York. I got an office on the 16th floor at 1330 Avenue of the Americas. I bought Gucci shoes and Paul Stewart suits. I hung out with the executives as much as I could. I did absolutely everything that Keith Jackson told me not to do. And the only other announcer who regularly and routinely came to 1330 Sixth Avenue was Cosell. And eventually, years later, not too far down the road, 1978 or so, Cosell got a new Saturday afternoon magazine show called Sports Beat. And Sports Beat was supposed to be the most meaningful television journalistic venture into sports that had yet taken place. And of course it would be, because the host was going to be Howard Cosell. But somebody had to get on an airplane and go out to do remote interviews to fill in that side of the ledger for the show. And by now I had some avid promoters within the organization. So I became Cosell's field reporter for SportsBeat, which occasioned a lot of contact between Howard and me. And I became accustomed to hearing him down the hall, standing out in front of the three secretaries in the SportsBeat offices. And there were some times when I had done something that he liked or approved of, and I would hear him say, you know, the kid, Lampley, is the only other on-air talking dog here who's capable of completing a complete sentence. None of the other morons can do that. He's really got to. He doesn't know or understand it. That was on a good day. Those were fairly rare. More often, I would hear him say, you know, he's a moron. Hired, promoted, he's a sophomore. Paid a six-figure salary with no background whatsoever. It's crazy. That was much more often the case. And my triumph within all that was that he was writing his books. And pretty frequently, when I was in the office, he would invite me down the hall to come sit in his office, and he would reach into his desk drawer and pull out the galley from his latest book. And he would read me 8, 10, 12 pages from the book. And I understood clearly that my job was to say, oh, Howard, that's amazing. Nobody else in the world could possibly write that kind of thing. You're the only person who understands sports the way that you do. And then I would go back down the hall, and eventually he would come out and stand in front of the secretaries and say, you know, the kid is the only one here who can complete a competent sentence. None of the other. And that would happen only on the days when I had come down the hall to say, yes, Howard, that's amazing.
you got that formula figured out pretty quickly.
Right. And then eventually, of course, he pulled himself off of the boxing telecast because he was so offended by Larry Holmes versus Tex Cobb. Apparently that was, you know, beyond any bogus matchup he had ever seen. The sport was full of bogus matchups even then, but Holmes-Cobb was too much for him. Or maybe he was just ready to go, and he pulled himself off of boxing. And a few years went by during which they tried some other options, calling the fights. And then eventually the company was sold to a station ownership company named Capital Cities Broadcasting. Capital Cities wanted to revamp a lot of things about it. They made Arledge give up the sports division because he was now president of news also. So they wanted him only to be the president of news, and Roone was out at sports. They wanted to put their own guy in charge of stations, so they moved the existing stations manager, a guy named Dennis Swanson, to be head of sports. Dennis Swanson arrived at sports with one predilection only, which was, who is Jim Lampley and how the hell do I get rid of him? And why are we paying him this very large contract, which I had negotiated after the 1984 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles, where I was both the swimming host and the late night host. And he just absolutely hated and despised the fact that I had that contract. He wanted to force me out. And he came up with the genius idea that assigning me to boxing would ruthlessly embarrass me on the air. A, I would be sort of in a delayed fashion following Cosell. Years had passed, but no one had really assumed Howard's identity in boxing. B, I was a preppy white kid from the East Coast, and obviously I would be allergic to boxing, and boxing would be allergic to me. So if he did this, it would kill me. Well, of course, he didn't know that the very first sports event I had ever really watched on television was Sugar Ray Robinson versus Bobo Olson in their second fight in 1955. And my mother sat me down to watch it. My father had died in 1954. And she said, you watch this. This is Friday Night Fights, sponsored by Gillette. In the next hour and a half, a gentleman named Don Dunphy is going to tell you everything you need to know about boxing. And I became an avid boxing fan. And I watched all the great fighters of the 50s, Carmen Basilio, Gene Fulmer, Sugar Ray Robinson, et cetera, Rocky Marciano. And I developed, an adolescent understanding of the sport, a great love for the sport. And in 1968, when I was 19 years old, I watched the 1960, when I was 11 years old. Let me correct that. 1960, when I was 11, I watched the Rome Olympics, and I saw an amateur light heavyweight named Cassius Clay. Now, I'm a white kid raised in the South by a double widowed Irish descended mother from Memphis. The last thing in the world you would have thought that that mother would have taught me in Hendersonville, North Carolina, was that racism was the cardinal sin. Most important thing in my life was that I would never, ever subscribe to racist ideas, become a racist like the people we knew, and I would resist it with every fiber of my body. So Cassius Clay was the ideal hero for me. You couldn't have drawn up a better hero. And I became an idolizer of Cassius Clay starting in 1960 and going on all the way through his career. So Dennis Swanson had no idea what he was doing when he assigned me to cover boxing in 1987. He was trying to get me to walk on that existing contract. And eventually I did. There was no point in staying at a network sports division where the head of the organization didn't want me when each of the other two network sports divisions did want me. So it was a good idea to walk on that contract, and I did. And I wound up leaving ABC to go to CBS. But by now, the boxing thing was underway. And the first fight I had done on ABC was our first coverage of a heavyweight prospect from New York named Mike Tyson. And Mike Tyson, very quickly as I was covering him, became the biggest new thing in the culture and a global public figure of enormous and immediate impact. And I was his original television biographer. So it only stood to reason that when HBO signed Mike Tyson to a contract, they would want to sign Jim Lampley to come with him. And there was room in my CBS contract for me to do things for a cable organization, a pay cable organization, which wasn't directly competitive. And so now I was working for CBS and HBO by 1988.
The phenomenal storyteller Jim Lampley with us on Musings on Sports. Jim, I know that the first HBO fight you did was Tyson Tony Tubbs in Japan in March of 88. First of all, what was that like for you to finally have gone and outside and working an HBO fight? But I also want to ask you, I know you did a number of really momentous fights. What happened with the Bo Gallata fight, with the riot at Madison Square Garden, with low blows? That had to be one of the craziest fights you'd ever covered, if not the.
Well, I've covered several sports events, which morphed into news events. And you know, sometimes they came in rapid fire succession. A little more than a week, 9 days after I covered the Bo Gallata fight in Madison Square Garden, that spawned an immediate riot in the garden afterward, I was on the air as late night co-host at the Atlanta Olympics with Hannah Storm when a bomb went off in Centennial Park. And we covered that together for a while until NBC could locate Tom Brokaw, who was out to dinner, and bring him in to take over on the set. And there were a variety of others. So I've had that experience many times of covering sports events that became news events. And to a certain degree, that may have had something to do with in 1988, becoming in the midst of my contract to be the sports director at KCBS TV in Los Angeles, I suddenly became the 5 and 11 o'clock nightly news anchor at KCBS in Los Angeles and remained in that position until 1992. So I've anchored sports and I've anchored news in major situations. As for Tyson and the Tubbs fight in Tokyo, I knew Mike very well. We had covered 5 of his fights on ABC, and the world saw him largely because of the 91-second knockout of Michael Spinks in Atlantic City on June 27, 1988. The world saw Tyson as totally invincible and, you know, somebody who was going to win every fight. But I had already seen his vulnerability on ABC. The second or third fight that I covered was a fight in upstate New York with veteran heavyweight James Quick Tillis of Tulsa, Oklahoma. And Tillis took Tyson all 10 rounds, and Tyson won what amounted to a 1-point decision. And there were various professional scribes and scorers at ringside who had Tillis winning the fight. So I already knew that Mike was not invincible against the right kind of boxer. And obviously what that is leading us to is February 10, 1990 in Tokyo, when distracted by his personal life, not terribly well prepared for the fight, underestimating the opponent, et cetera, Mike became the victim of the biggest upset in boxing history when he lost to Buster Douglas on a 10th round knockout. And the prelude to that is that the very first live prize fight I had ever attended was February 25, 1964 in Miami Beach, when I had bought a $100 ticket from lawn mowing and car washing money to see Cassius Clay fight Sonny Liston in a fight in which Liston was, you know, like Tyson against Douglas, Liston was basically a 40 or 50 to 1 betting favorite over Clay in Miami Beach. And I went to root for Cassius Clay and see the upset that I was so hoping and dreaming would happen. And it did happen. And I went home and got up on the roof of my crappy tract house in southwest Miami and started yelling, "I've upset the world. I'm the greatest of all time," waking up the neighbors until my mother came out and said, "Please come down off of the roof before we both get arrested." And now fast forward 26 years and I'm sitting at ringside in Tokyo while Douglas wins round after round. And eventually it occurs to me, wow, the very first live prize fight you ever saw was Clay's upset of Liston, which was called by everyone the biggest upset in boxing history. And now you're calling the fight, which is going to dislodge it, as the biggest upset in boxing history. And that's what happened. And when something like that takes place in front of your eyes, given everything which had led me down my path to that moment, you are absolutely forced to come to the conclusion that this is destiny. I was meant to be here. There's nobody else who was supposed to call this fight, because I'm the only person with the specific background that has brought me here. And then, you know, I flew home to Los Angeles and anchored the nightly news on KCBS that night.
Jim, what did you see from Tyson in terms of the flaw or flaws that led up to Buster in that fight?
Mostly there was an inner insecurity in Mike, the inevitable product of his fractured, fragmented, extremely difficult background, that meant that his confidence would ultimately be paper thin if he ran into something that was bothersome to him. And if you look at the physical profile, Mike was a little over 5'10". Buster was 6'4". Buster was a conventional boxer with a very good jab and a right hand that he brought directly over the top, where it was difficult for Mike to see that punch coming. And from the first round on, Buster was landing that combination: jab, right hand over the top, jab, right hand over the top. Mike couldn't do anything to stop it. And I'm not going to tell you that I knew anything before the fight. Before the fight, I was enough of a Tyson idolator from my previous coverage of him on ABC that I assumed he would annihilate Buster Douglas, who had looked very average in the qualifier fight against Tony Tucker. But styles make fights, and Buster had exactly the right style to give Mike that kind of trouble at that stage of Mike's career.
Well, I thought I needed to attend your class at the University of North Carolina before I heard you tell stories. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that I better somehow find out how I can attend that class. Jim Lampley, you have been a treasure to have on Musings on Sports, and we appreciate your time and continued success, my friend.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover. The smarter Tour Ball.
We thank Jim Lampley. He was absolutely terrific. You can understand why he is a professor in a class called storytelling. He certainly is quite able when it comes to telling great stories.
Yeah, he probably will be sending us an invitation that, hey, you two guys ought to join my class. And I actually would love that, and so yeah. Would you. We think we're good, but we can always get better. Speaking of better, we've got a special guest for next week.
Yeah, unique situation. Dan Quinn, 14-year National Hockey League standout, who at the end of his career started playing golf, and he ended up winning a number of the celebrity golf tournaments, and is living down here in South Florida, not far from me. It's going to be really interesting perspective to hear from a guy at the very top of his chosen profession as a hockey player, and then what he turned into being a really, really good amateur golfer at the celebrity circuit. So looking forward to having Dan Quinn on next week. Bob, good being with you. Glad there were a lot more treats than tricks last night. Thank you all for listening to Musings on Sports. You can hear us on all of the podcast platforms. Kelly Elbin signing off for Musings on Sports.